This is the Daily Actor Podcast. I'm Lance Carter, and in this episode, we're talking to Ralph Fiennes. Hey guys, happy 2014! I'm really going to try and make this year the best that I can. I've written all of my goals on this big whiteboard that I have here in my office, and I'm ready to start this year running. I hope you are too. If you need any help or advice with your acting career, feel free to give me a shout. I love helping you guys. For our first interview of 2014, I thought we'd start it off with a bang. We're talking to Ralph Fiennes. He's got a new film called The Invisible Woman that he not only stars in, but also directs. Kristen Burt got a chance to talk with him.
Hi, this is Kristen Burt for Daily Actor. I spoke with Ralph Fiennes in early December during a roundtable discussion about The Invisible Woman. Now, Ralph is such a smart but unassuming actor. He's thoughtful with his answers, and you can see the passion in his work both on and off screen. Besides making sure to pronounce his name correctly, yes, it's Ralph versus the Americanized Ralph, I wanted to hear more about his approach to such an iconic literary figure like Charles Dickens. Now, we've seen him in Oscar-nominated roles like Schindler's List and The English Patient, but I wanted to know how he got into the mind of Charles Dickens, who is seemingly so simple from first glance, but he had a pretty complex personal life. If you see The Invisible Woman, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Now, Ralph wasn't planning on starring in The Invisible Woman. He was only going to direct, but as pre-production went on, it became pretty clear that he was right for the role. Another big name actor whom he didn't say who it was, but he did turn him down. So that's how Ralph wound up stepping in to playing Charles Dickens. Felicity Jones was already attached to the film, so it became a lovely partnership both on and off screen. Now, one interesting note is that Ralph said his next project that he directs, he's going to stay off camera because it's too difficult to wear multiple hats on set. But no matter what he tackles, it's sure to be pretty darn good. Be sure to check out The Invisible Woman, which opens in limited release on December 25th, and then it'll have a bigger launch in January 2014. Now, before we head over to the interview, I'm going to hand it back to Lance to wrap it up.
Thanks, Kristen. And now, it's plug time. If you need a website or casting director mailing labels, career coaching, lists of headshot photographers in your area, we've got all of that and more. Also, if you have questions about your career, the site, whatever, send me an email on our contact page or check out the sidebar on the site and look for that big blue Ask Me pick. When you do that, you'll be able to leave me a quick voicemail, and I might use that in a future podcast. You can find all of that out on dailyactor.com. And now, here's the interview.
Did you choose to star in what you're directing because that way you don't have to argue with the director, or because that was how you got the film made?
No, I think I was reluctant to, not because it was a bad part, because it was a fantastic part, but having done Coriolanus and done both, it's really hard. It's really just your headspace in a vice trying to, you know, how you negotiate doing justice to your own performance while making sure everyone else is taken care of. That was really under pressure, budgetary pressure, time pressure, so... And this was offered to me, well, it was offered to me with, you know, if you want to play Dickens, really, just in case the BBC would be happy. And I said, no, I don't think I could. And I sort of feel myself, okay, that's a great part. but I did approach another actor. It didn't go anywhere. I think, I can't say who it is, but I sense that they didn't really want to go, they didn't like the fact that Dickens might be unlikable, which is actually what I like about it. Anyway, I worked on it, you know, I worked on the screenplay in depth with Abby Morgan, and we would look at scenes and I would say the lines and do everyone's lines. And in doing it, I read Dickens, of course, and it just got under my skin. And finally I said, okay, I'll do it. But I worked with a great lady called Joan Washington, who's a dialect coach, but actually she's got fantastic sensitivity to performance, truth of performance. And she helped me on Coriolanus, so I know I had her there. Here on this film, also a great script supervisor. They gave me, I think the thing I learned from Coriolanus was if you can do both, you must. I erred on shortchanging myself, i.e., when I sat in the rushes of Coriolanus, I wished I'd done another take. I wish I'd fought, even if it cost us more to go. You know, I was rushing, scrambling to do important moments under pressure. So this time around, I fought harder to have more time. This was 10 weeks as opposed to 8 weeks, just so I knew I'd got to have time. And that helped. But it's, I'm longing now, if I do direct again, which I'd like to do, to not direct it, just direct.
Now, one of the truly spectacular aspects of this film is Rob Hardy's cinematography.
Yeah.
How did you and Rob go about developing your visual tone that really creates its own leg or tine of the story and mirrors the emotional palette you have?
Mm. Well, I felt my starting point was this is a story of intimacy. It's like the gradations of a relationship. And I was seeing a lot of scenes of people in rooms, relatively static. And it seemed to me that what goes on in the face of Felicity is essentially the Dickens and other people, that what happens inside people is that the subtext is really important. And I didn't want to... I think I've seen some period films where you feel the author of the film is anxious and they need to keep it jazzy because they're worried that it's going to be staid or stiff or something. And I thought, well, no, it is what it is. This is a time of certain formality. People wear certain clothes. I didn't want to shy away from that. And it seemed to me that the camera is relatively still and it can move in and out, but essentially there's an observational quality about the camera that it allows itself to watch. And to me, that made me think about how you frame, so that the frame itself is rich. It has a dynamic, has a tension, has a compositional consideration to it. So, and I was trying to articulate, these are sort of half-thought things when I talked to Rob about, you know, I wanted to embrace the close-up that can watch, and that compositionally, like we looked at paintings a lot, about how we composed those shots. So like a scene I really love for this example is the scene with Nellie and Catherine. I love the way that we had 2-3-5 format, a wide frame format. And so how you decide that face and figure and what's going on to the side of them and around them, that was a big consideration. So Rob and I would spend quite a lot of time choosing the right lens and agreeing on the position. But I like, he just has one of the reasons I love him, his compositional eye is really strong. He does, and he takes just something that's slightly off the conventional position. An example that I love would be in the scene where they count the money together. I said to him, they're opposite each other, across a table. I just think the camera is reasonably square onto them. And that's how, and he said, fine. We shot that scene, and I thought it looked great. But he said, please, can I just shoot the close-ups again, putting the camera a little bit higher? I said, yeah, of course. And actually, in rushes, when I looked at that, I had a mass of material to choose from. So it was, but those are the close-ups which we used towards the second half of that scene. And they're fantastic. I mean, that's his, because he's just up here, and it creates a kind of tension of the way you're slightly looking down, and you're not crazily high, but it just creates, there's a shot with me where my eye is just under this bit, and it kind of stands out in a weird way, which it doesn't in the conventional. So it's about Rob's eyes finding these slightly off-center positions that are observed, and they're relatively formal, but slightly unusual. So I don't know if that's answered your question.
And what do you impress the most about Charles Dickens' life and his personality?
What impresses me is his furious work ethic, his energy. He was a man of crazy energy, exhausting. He'd walk these crazy distances. He then would write, and then not only would he write the installments for his books, but he would then write this, we show it in the film, this journal all the year round, or Household Words. You know, I think there was a sort of vitality to him which is attractive, slightly terrifying because it's so strong. So that appeals to me. And I've discovered him quite late. I didn't know much Charles Dickens. I had somehow sort of blanked him as being an area that I wasn't going to be interested in. I'd read Little Dorrit. I was familiar with adaptations. It was only when I read this screenplay and then Claire's book that I sort of went, oh, this guy, quite complicated. He's not the bouncy, smiley, jolly. He's, and that with, and in a sort of detailed reading of his works, you see this sort of shadowy, violent, conflicted, and a sort of darkly comic element to him, which he's slightly mad. He's like a sort of slightly crazy child, Dickens. I think he would like to be centre of attention. He was very fastidiously organised. And like a crazy child, when you say to the child, you have to stop playing now, or you were wrong, he gets really mad. And so that's the rather a harder side of Dickens, is this sort of defensiveness that he's never in the wrong. He never seems to want to be in the wrong.
What did you pay attention to play the Charles Dickens? You have so much impression and surprising and the research, but what did you most pay attention to play him? Because he has many friends, but we never seen him in person.
So we never see him?
We never seen him in person because he's died so long ago. So we didn't know him. Mm. So what did you most pay attention to play him?
Well, the first thing is that, I mean, there's a lot of material that describes him. Detailed descriptions, anecdotes, memories of him. His children have written about him. And so I guess it's a bit like you're building up a kind of profile from written memories of Dickens and what he was like. The thing that emerged for me mostly was his vitality. He was sort of always on. So that's what I've tried to show in the scene where they're rehearsing and the party afterwards in Manchester, when he brings the Turnhams back to his house and he's saying, let's have champagne, and he talks and he's kind of up. And so that was something I felt, everyone who reads about Dickens talks about his vitality. So that was the thing that I wanted to make, attempt to make sure that people felt in the film.
Being an actor and director, what was the most stressful part of the entire film? Was it the pre-production, the actual shooting, or was it post-production?
The most stressful part has got to be the shooting. Just because weather's changing and, I probably shoot quite a lot of takes. It's a very performance-driven film, and I'm looking, I think I want to find that moment, that magic moment. Great actors are in this film, they come prepared, but I know for myself, you come ready, but you want to find that place where the bit of you that's not prepared sort of bursts out, and there's little moments of sort of this weird thing called the truthful thing, where suddenly the actor finds another level, and that takes time. So that, and if you're using up time, suddenly at the end of the day you're going, oh fuck, I've got only got half an hour to shoot these three big close-ups, and that becomes stressful. Mm-hmm. And also it becomes kind of addictive, because it's a kind of crazy thing. I get a kind of like, I'm not going to be beaten by this feeling.
do you think Dickens was consciously aware that he was coercing Nellie, or he was telling himself something else was going on there?
I think that's a really good question. I think he would not have liked to have been honest with himself, which is why he helps the Turnham family. And we have a scene, often he gets them the houses. But I think he was in love with her, and it took a long time for him to... I think he lurches, he acts with generosity to the Turnhams as a way to get to know him. I don't think he's clear to himself about it necessarily. And then when he finally does leave the family, he's kind of very self-defensive about it. I think he's sort of constantly in denial. So, he was obsessively secret.
And so I have a question. The film is bookended by these plays that's being put on by children or adolescents. And so they were believable as actors who weren't quite seasoned. So how did you get that sort of nuanced performance where it's like they're actors?
Well, the young boys at the beginning?
Yeah. It's like they're making kind of obvious choices. And so was that... you didn't want them to be like on the nose because they were actors playing amateur actors. So what was that, directing those scenes like?
Oh, I love directing those scenes. There were these boys from this school in London. They went through an audition process where I wanted the best of the crop, but they still came with their lack of their innocence. So we selected a lot of... Actually, it's a shame. I was a bit in love with this sequence, because I love a lot of scenery and a lot of time and thought went into it. It's become whittled down.
Right.
They came with this. I mean, I had to I had to give them quite sort of coercive acting lessons. Sometimes sometimes, you know, they needed a bit of guidance. But they were very, very sweet and very good. They come from a school that's known for its producing musicians and actors, and it puts a lot of resources into drama and music.
So you have to give them notes and adjustments a lot during those days when you were filming them?
I mean, I remember things like when they had to talk about the storm is coming, I had to say, you know, look, like basic stuff, imagine what it's like. You see the storm coming in and you ask a question to really ask it, you know, what, you know, just getting to really be inside the lines that they... I mean, acting's about imagination, you know, it's about really imagining something, so it was getting them to just really reinforce their imagination.
So how was actor Ray Fiennes at taking direction from director Ray Fiennes?
Well, I think I'm probably... I tend to be quite sort of fussy and perfectionist about, you know, it's never right. It can always be better. And it's just difficult when you're under pressure and you've got to, you know, I really very much depended on Joan Washington and my script supervisor. I really depended on them to say, and Susanna, who's a script supervisor, as well as Joan, I really trusted her sense of, I'd wanted to be right. I'd say, I think we're there, aren't we? Part of, because I knew I had to move on, and there might be, and I'd say, isn't that, and she said, and she would go, yeah, I don't know, very fine. And I would go, shall I go again? Yes, no, go.
In the film, Nellie's mom kept saying, you know, he's a good man, Mr. Dickens, he's a good man. I felt her character was rather contemporary because she kind of knew what was happening, what was going on. Mm. She was not at all... She wasn't very judgmental about it. She was guarded, but she wasn't judgmental about it. And I kind of want to know do you know a lot about her character historically? Do you know if that's how she was or how she could have been? Because it just seems that any mother at that time would have been like, oh my gosh, no, we have to get you away. She would have taken her to France and sent her or something, but she was very, all right, well, my daughter might end up becoming the mistress of someone else. All right, well, that's fine. She just seemed...
Well, first of all, it's a good question. She's quite well documented in Claire's book, and it does seem that she acquiesced in this relationship. Claire's book is really worth reading if you're at all interested in actresses and the way women actresses were perceived and how they had to survive in the 19th century. But the first two or three chapters of the book go to great lengths to talk about women, the theatre, actresses, how you had to fight for respectability in the theatre, survival, and how within the theatre, people often made arrangements, had love affairs outside of marriage, and often she talks about famously one of the heirs to the throne had a famous actress as a mistress, and she actually supported this man. When he became king, he ditched her. All this is part of a sort of a wider look at survival of women and matches made. And Claire, I read it many, many times. There's one page where she really hones in on what was Mrs. Turner's role in this. And she cites other plays where women, a mother has enabled a happy union, romantic union, outside of marriage, because it was stability. It was financial survival. And so one of my biggest things I learned was the Victorians were making all these sort of deals, you know, in and around the very strict taboos of the time. And it's all based on what my interpretation of Claire's book about this character, that she acquiesced in it, that Dickens helped. That's why the scene there, which I like how, I mean, I'm sort of proud of it, I suppose, because Abby wrote it and I liked it. It's as if after Dickens has gone to tea at their house, and there's been the subtlest of stuff between Dickens and Nellie, which we'd really tried not to hit too hard, but like any mother, mothers pick up on stuff that's going on. She goes in to give Dickens his coat. He makes a comment about the house, and she says, well, we're often something like, you know, we don't have much money, but I wouldn't have it any other way. He offers his help. And it's as if she knows what... And my interpretation, and obviously the audience have to work quite hard here, because it's not spelled out. But what my thinking is, this is the mother who's seen what's going on. He's offering help, and she just goes right for it, and she says, I cannot risk Nelly's reputation, i.e., I know that your help is about getting to my daughter. Right. And she says, the reputation I won't risk. So that's the part of her that you're talking about. Yeah. You can't risk the reputation. But later on, she is seen that Dickens's attention has a reality to it, which if Nelly hasn't got much of a future, there is an accommodation that can be made. And it's a hard one to get our heads around for the reasons you're expressing, but it's only based on what's in the book. And it was a challenge to write it and do it, and it may not have entirely succeeded, but I do think that there was a point where Mrs. Ternan, the real Mrs. Ternan, let this thing happen. And I'm sure she would have been absolutely insistent that it had to be honourable, that it had to be secret, but it meant that her daughter has been looked after quite well by one of the most famous men of the age.
Thanks, Rafe, and thank you guys for listening. Check out The Invisible Woman when you can. And keep coming back to Daily Actor for more great interviews, news from film, TV, and theater, and so much more. Follow me on Twitter at Daily Actor and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/Daily Actor. Also, follow Kristen on Twitter, Kristen Burt, KristenBurtt. Thanks for supporting the advertisers. I'm Lance, and I'll talk to you soon.